great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us live at accesssacramento.org, or you can hear this program and past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Today's program is The Fog of War, from the audio section of the movie Fog of War, which features the life of former Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. He served under President Kennedy and Johnson. He reflects on his part in the bombing of Tokyo, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the Vietnam War. This film could have been titled The Evil That Men Do, but that's already taken. He talks about war crimes he and others committed. He observes the failures of government officials at the highest level to understand the basis of wars they direct.
The U.S. Air Force had a new airplane named the B-29. B-17s and B-24s in Europe bombed from 15, 16,000 feet. The problem was that they were subject to anti-aircraft fire and to fighter aircraft. To relieve that, this B-29 was being developed with bomb from high altitude, and it was thought we could destroy targets much more efficiently and effectively. I was brought back from the 8th Air Force and assigned to the 1st B-29s, the 58th Bomb Wing. We had to fly those planes from the bases in Kansas to India. Then we had to fly fuel over the hump into China. Airfields were built with Chinese labor. It was an insane operation. I can still remember them hauling these huge rollers to crush the stone, make them flat. Long rope, somebody had slipped, the roller would roll over and everybody would laugh and go on. We were supposed to take these B-29s, there were no tanker aircraft, we were to fill them with fuel, fly from India to Chengdu, offload the fuel, fly back to India, make enough missions to build up fuel in Chengdu, fly to Iwata, Japan, bomb the steel mills, and go back to India. We had so little training on this problem of maximizing efficiency, we actually found to get some of the B-29s back, instead of offloading fuel, they had to take it on. To make a long story short, it wasn't worth a damn. And it was LeMay who really came to that conclusion and led the chiefs to move the whole thing to the Marianas, which devastated Japan. Focused on only one thing, target destruction. Most Air Force generals could tell you how many planes they had, how many tons of bombs they dropped, or whatever the hell it was, but he was the only person that I knew in the senior command of the Air Force who focused solely on the loss of his crews per unit of target destruction. I was on the island of Guam, in his command, in March of 1945, in that single night, we burned to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in Tokyo, men, women, and children.
you aware this was going to happen?
Well, I was part of a mechanism that in a sense recommended it. I analyzed bombing operations and how to make them more efficient, i.e., not more efficient in the sense of killing more, but more efficient in weakening the adversary. I wrote one report analyzing the efficiency of the B-29 operations. The B-29 could get above the fighter aircraft, above the air defense, so the loss rate would be much less. The problem was, the accuracy was also much less. Now, I don't want to suggest that it was my report that led to, I'll call it, the firebombing. It isn't that I'm trying to absolve myself of blame for the firebombing. I don't want to suggest that it was I that put in LeMay's mind that his operations were totally inefficient and had to be drastically changed. But anyhow, that's what he did. He took the B-29s down to 5,000 feet, and he decided to bomb with firebombs. I participated in the interrogation of the B-29 bomber crews that came back that night. A room full of crewmen and intelligence interrogators. The captain got up, young captain, and said, "God damn it, I'd like to know who this son of a bitch was that took this magnificent airplane designed to bomb from 23,000 feet, and he took it down to 5,000 feet, and I lost my wingman." He was shot and killed. LeMay spoke in monosyllables. I never heard him say more than two words in sequence. It was basically, yes, no, yep. That's all right, hell with it. That was all he said. And LeMay was totally intolerant of criticism. He never engaged in discussion with anybody. He stood up. "Why are we here? Why are we here? You lost your wingman. It hurts me as much as it does you. I sent him there. And I've been there. I know what it is. But you lost one wingman, and we destroyed Tokyo." "50 square miles of Tokyo were burned. Tokyo was a wooden city, and when we dropped these firebombs, and it just burned it."
Choice of incendiary bombs. Where did that come from?
I think the issue is not so much incendiary bombs. I think the issue is, in order to win a war, should you kill 100,000 people in one night by firebombing or any other way? LeMay's answer would be clearly yes. McNamara, do you mean to say that instead of killing 100,000, burning to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in that one night, we should have burned to death a lesser number or none? And then had our soldiers cross the beaches in Tokyo and been slaughtered in the tens of thousands? Is that what you're proposing? Is that moral? Is that wise? Why was it necessary to drop the nuclear bomb if LeMay was burning up Japan? And he went on from Tokyo to firebomb other cities. 58% of Yokohama. Yokohama is roughly the size of Cleveland. 58% of Cleveland destroyed. Tokyo is roughly the size of New York. 51% of New York destroyed. 99% of the equivalent of Chattanooga, which was Toyama. 40% of the equivalent of Los Angeles, which was Nagoya. This was all done before the dropping of the nuclear bomb, which, by the way, was dropped by LeMay's command. Proportionality should be a guideline in war. killing 50 to 90% of the people of 67 Japanese cities and then bombing them with two nuclear bombs is not proportional, in the minds of some people, to the objectives we were trying to achieve. I don't fault Truman for dropping the nuclear bomb. The U.S.-Japanese War was one of the most brutal wars in all of human history. Kamikaze pilots, suicide, unbelievable. What one can criticize is that the human race prior to that time and today has not really grappled with what are, I'll call it, the rules of war. Was there a rule then that said you shouldn't bomb, shouldn't kill, shouldn't burn to death 100,000 civilians in a night? LeMay said, if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals. And I think he's right. He, and I'd say I, were behaving as war criminals. LeMay recognized that what he was doing would be thought immoral if his side had lost. But what makes it immoral if you lose and not immoral if you win?
I want you to dictate to me a memorandum, a couple of pages, four-letter words and short sentences on the situation in Vietnam, the Vietnam picture. This morning, Senator Scott said that the war, which we can neither win, lose, nor drop, is evidence of an instability of ideas, a floating series of judgments, our policy of nervous conciliation, which is extremely disturbing. You think it's a mistake to explain about Vietnam and what we're faced with?
Well, I do think, Mr. President, that it'd be wise for you to say as little as possible. The frank answer is we don't know what's going on out there. The signs I see coming through the cables are disturbing signs. It's a very uncertain period.
We need somebody over there that can give us a better plan than we got. What I want is somebody that can lay up some plans to trap these guys and whip hell out of them, kill some of them. That's what I want to do.
Well, I'll try and bring something back that will meet that objective.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you.
At some point, we have to approach Vietnam, and I want to know how you can best set that up for me.
Yeah, well, that's a hard question. I think we have to approach it in the context of the Cold War. But first, I'll have to talk about Ford. I've got to go back to the end of the war. I had a terrible headache. So Mark drove me into the Air Force Regional Hospital. A week later, Mark came in. Many of the same symptoms. It's hard to believe, and I don't think I've ever heard of another case, where two individuals, husband and wife, came down essentially at the same time with polio. They were both in the hospital on VJ Day. A friend of mine said, we're going to find a corporation in America that needs the advice and capabilities of this extraordinary group of people I'm going to bring together, and you got to be part of it. I said, to hell with it. Not going to be part. I'm going back to Harvard. That's what Mark and I want to do. I'm going to spend my life there. He said, look, Bob, you can't pay Mark's hospital bills. You're crazy as hell. He said, by the way, the company that most needs our help in all of the U.S. is Ford. Well, I said, how'd you learn that? Oh, he said, I read an article in Life magazine. Of the top 1,000 executives at Ford Motor Company, I don't believe there were 10 college graduates. And Henry Ford, second, needed help. They were going to give us tests. 2 full days of testing. Intelligence tests, achievement tests, personality tests, you name it. this sounds absurd, but I remember one of the questions on one of the tests was, would you rather be a florist or a coal miner? I should tell you, I had been a florist. I worked as a florist during some of my Christmas vacation. I put down coal miner. I think the reasons are obvious to you. This group of 10 people had been trained in the Officer Candidate School at Harvard. In some tests, we actually had the highest marks that had been scored. In other tests, we were in the upper one percentile. From 1926 to 1946, including the war years, Ford Motor Company just barely broke even. It was a god-awful mess. I thought we had a responsibility to the stockholders. And God knows, you cannot believe how bad the situation had been. They didn't have a market research organization. I set one up. The manager said to me, what do you want me to study? I said, find out who in the hell's buying the Volkswagens. Everybody says it's a no good car. It was only selling about 20,000 a year. But I want to know what's going to happen. Is it going to stay the same or go down or go up? Find out who buys them. He came back 6 months later. He said, well, they're professors and they're doctors and they're lawyers. And they're obviously people who can afford more. Well, that set me to thinking about what we in the industry should do. Was there a market we were missing? At this time, nobody believed Americans wanted cheaper cars. They wanted conspicuous consumption. Cadillac, with these huge, ostentatious fins, set the style for the industry for 10 or 15 years. And that's what we were up against. We introduced the Falcon as a more economical car. And it was a huge success profit-wise. We accomplished a lot. I said, what about accidents? I hear a lot about accidents. Oh, yes. We'll get you some data on that. There were about 40-odd thousand deaths per year from automobile accidents and about a million or a million two injuries. And I said, well, what causes it? Well, he said, it's obvious. It's human error and mechanical failure. He said, hell, if it's mechanical failure, we might be involved. Let's dig into this. I want to know if it's mechanical failure, I want to stop it. Well, I said, there's really nothing, very few statistics available. I said, damn it, find out. What can we learn? They said, well, the only place we can find that knows anything about it is Cornell Aeronautical Labs. They said the major problem is packaging. They said, you buy eggs and you know how eggs come in a carton. I said, no, I don't buy eggs. My wife does it. Well, they said, you talk to her and ask her. When she puts that carton down on the drain board, when she gets home, do the eggs break? And so I asked Laurie, she said, no. So Cornell said, they don't break because they're packaged properly. Now, if we packaged people in cars the same way, we could reduce the breakage. We lacked lab facilities, so we dropped human skulls in different packages down the stairwells of the dormitories at Cornell. Well, that sounds absurd, but that guy was absolutely right. It was packaging which could make the difference. In a crash, the driver was often impaled on the steering wheel. The passenger was often injured because he'd hit the windshield or the header bar or the instrument panel. So, in the 1956 model Ford, we introduced steering wheels that prevented being impaled. We introduced padded instrument panels, and we introduced seat belts. We estimated if there would be 100% use of the seat belts, we could save 20-odd thousand lives a year. Everybody was opposed to it. You couldn't get people to use seatbelts. But those who did saved their lives. In much up ahead. It's July 1960. John Bugis, Vice President of Industrial Relations, clearly had his eyes on becoming president. I'm the group vice president in charge of all of the car divisions. Henry was a night owl. He always wanted to go out into town. You know, it's 2 a.m. or something or other. He said, "Bob, come on up and have a nightcap." I said, "God damn it, Henry, I don't want a nightcap. I'm going to bed." John says, "I'll come up, Henry." Henry said, "I didn't ask you, John. I asked Bob." He said, "Bob, come on up." So I finally went up. That's when he asked me to be president. I was the first president of the company in the history of the company that had ever been president other than a member of the Ford family. And after 5 weeks, I quit. The telephone rang. The person comes on and says, "I'm Robert Kennedy. My brother, Jack Kennedy, would like you to meet our brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver." 4 o'clock, Sarge comes in, never met him, and he said, "I've been authorized by my brother-in-law, Jack Kennedy, to offer you the position Secretary of the Treasury." I said, "You're out of your mind. I know a little bit about finance, but I'm not qualified to be Secretary of the Treasury." Anticipating you might say that, the president-elect authorized me to offer you the Secretary of Defense. I said, "Look, I was in World War II for 3 years, but Secretary of Defense, I'm not qualified to be Secretary of Defense." Well, he said, anticipating that, he said, "Would you at least do him the courtesy of agreeing to meet with him?" So I go home, I meet with Marg. If I could appoint every senior official in the department, and then if I could be guaranteed I wouldn't have to be part of that damn Washington social world. She said, "Well, okay, why don't you write a contract with the president, and if he'll accept those two conditions, do it." My total net worth at the time was on the order of $800,000, but I had huge unfulfilled stock options worth millions, and I was one of the highest paid executives in the world. And the future was, of course, brilliant. We had called our children in. Their life would be totally changed. The salary of a cabinet secretary then was $25,000 a year. So we explained to the children that they'd be giving up their future. They could care less. Marg could care less. It was snowing. The Secret Service took me in the house by the back way. I can still see it. There's a love seat, two armchairs with a lamp table in between. Jack Kennedy's sitting in one armchair and Bobby Kennedy's sitting in the other. "Mr. President, it's absurd. I'm not qualified." "Look, Bob," he said, "I don't think there's any school for presidents either." He said, "Let's announce it right now." He said, "I'll write out the announcement." So he wrote out the announcement. We walk out the front door. All of these television cameras, impressive, till hell wouldn't have it. That's how Marg learned I'd accept it. It was on television, live.
"All right, why don't we, let me do some pictures afterwards. I have asked Robert McNamara to assume the responsibilities of Secretary of Defense, and I'm glad and happy to say that he has accepted this responsibility. Mr. McNamara leaves the presidency of the Ford Company at great personal sacrifice."
That's the way it began. You know, it was a traumatic period. My wife probably got ulcers from it, may even ultimately have died from the stress. My son got ulcers. It was very traumatic, but they were some of the best years of our life, and all members of my family benefited from it. It was terrific. October 2nd. I had returned from Vietnam. At that time, we had 16,000 military advisors. I recommended to President Kennedy and to the Security Council that we establish a plan and an objective of removing all of them within 2 years.
"Has anybody been taking about this? Say to the Congress and the people, we do have a plan for reducing the exposure of U.S. combat personnel. My reservation about it is that the war doesn't continue to go well. It looks like we were overly optimistic.
We can either way to get out of Vietnam, just the way of doing it.
Kennedy announced we were going to pull out all of our military advisors by the end of 65. We're going to take 1,000 out at the end of 63, and we did. But there was a coup in South Vietnam. Diem was overthrown, and he and his brother were killed. I was present with the president when together we received information of that coup. I have never seen him more upset. He totally blanched. President Kennedy and I had tremendous problems with Diem, but my God, he was the authority. He was the head of state, and he was overthrown by a military coup. And Kennedy knew, and I knew, that to some degree, the U.S. government was responsible for that.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.